We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Support for this podcast comes from Wild Turkey Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey. Let's tune in to their one-on-one with Jamal, a real bartender from Old Fourth Ward in Atlanta.
I really get into the backstory of whatever I'm pouring. Out of respect, there are literally years of experience behind these bottles. Wild Turkey, same recipe since 1942. If you want a true classic, this is what you want to order.
Wild Turkey. Wild Turkey Distilling Company, Lawrenceburg, Kentucky. Copyright 2020, Campari American, New York, New York. Never compromise, drink responsibly.
Welcome to the RotoWire NBA podcast. It is Wednesday, December 14th. Nick Whalen here with DJ Trainer. Want to wish a happy birthday to Anthony Mason. First things first, got to get that out of the way. Rest in peace to Anthony Mason, one of my all-time favorite players. And I recently discovered that Basketball Reference has this great tool that allows you to basically see what happened on a given day at any point in basketball history. So I spent a good deal of time last night and a little bit today during the afternoon, just kind of seeing what happened on this day on December 14th in history. So it's the five-year anniversary of the Chris Paul deal, the real one. You hear all the time, it's like, oh, it's the, I think it was like earlier this week or last week, it was the five-year anniversary, of course, of Chris Paul not being traded to the Lakers. This is the five-year anniversary of a trade that actually happened, where he went from New Orleans to the Clippers, which it seems like forever ago that he was in New Orleans, right? Like 5 years, you know, I guess when you think of it in time like that, it seems about right. But like, to me, he's just been in the Clipper for as long as I can remember.
I mean, Byron Scott coached him back in the day and things
former coach changed. Of the year, Byron Scott.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And I mean, our opinion of Byron Scott has certainly changed since then. So a lot has transpired. You're right. Since Chris Paul was on mm-hmm. the New Orleans team.
Yeah. Elsewhere in 2001, Kevin Garnett had a 29 point, 24 rebound, 8 assist, 2 steal, 1 block game. That's a pretty good game. That's a lot of stats. In 2005, Andre Kirilenko, friend of the program, had 21 points, 16 boards, 8 blocks, 3 assists, and 2 steals.
Sorry, I didn't want to cut you off while you
were talking. Yeah, I didn't let you cut me off.
I wanted to be known he's a best friend of the program, not just a friend.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, yeah, I guess.
We hang out with him all the time.
Yeah, I wish we did. And in 2010, another best friend of the program, personal best friend of mine, Darko Milicic, 25-11 in a loss to the Golden State Warriors. That one was when he was a member of the Minnesota Timberwolves. So don't let anyone try to tell you that he was a bust. He had a 25-11 game at one point about 6 years ago.
Yeah, I think we've lost Nick just to this feature on Basketball Reference. I think your family and friends are going to, you know, confront you one day very soon and just be like, you haven't been hanging out, you haven't been answering our texts, and you're just going to be running down every single day what happened on this day in NBA history.
Well, it's just a nice reminder. Like, I was looking back at, you know, what happened on this day, and like, I started with like 95 and went all the way to like 2014, and there's like Anthony Peeler had like a 25-point game, and like, you know, guys like Antonio Daniels had like a 15 assist game, and Grievous Vasquez had like an 18 assist game. It was like, what? It just reminds you that like these guys that we think of now as, you know, either has-beens who are out of the league, or someone like Vasquez who it seems like hasn't played in like 2 years, that at one point like their perception was maybe totally different, even if only for a day or for a week.
Yeah, no, that's completely true. I got a question for you. Tomorrow's December 15th. It's
yes.
Right? Yeah.
Is that the question?
Yeah,
correct. It is.
Yes, correct. Players that were signed during the offseason are now eligible to be traded. Do you think that any teams will trade with each other tomorrow, December 15th?
Not really. No, I don't think so. I don't think it'll be an immediate thing. Like you said, the guys who were signed this offseason, basically if you've used the trade machine in the last like couple months and you see the players that have a little like restriction next to them, like that's going to clear out. So that's going to be a lot of fun. Is like you can kind of, you know, expand your horizons with the trade machine that ESPN puts out. But no, I mean, I don't think we'll see anything right away. You know, the deals will trickle out as they always do, maybe one or two before the deadline, and then you know, everything will kind of fast forward, of course, you know, once we get to around the All-Star break, but I'm not expecting any major fireworks.
All right. Yeah. I mean, I would love to think that teams already have deals kind of underneath the table, just ready to go. But I'll probably be fooling myself or talking myself.
I mean, which of those guys is like just lining up to be traded right now?
Well, it's mostly so far. It's mostly that, you know, like one piece of a bigger trade is now in place. So it's not just like, oh, it's going to be a frenzy of all those guys that signed this summer. It's more like, all right, now all the building blocks are in place. Anything that could happen before the trade deadline can now actually happen. So in theory, that could start tomorrow.
True. So, you know, if you want to throw out an example like DeMarcus Cousins, you know, it seems like you can read one report, you can read another report a few days later. One says he's getting traded. One says the Kings aren't entertaining any talks. But, you know, in that situation, a guy like Matt Barnes can now be thrown in. Aaron Aflalo, Anthony Tolliver, Garrett Temple, like little pieces like that. And, you know, a team like Orlando that has compiled this really weird talent. You know, Fournier signed the extension, so he's somebody that wouldn't be eligible.
The Blazers,
yeah, they're the one team I think that, if there's one team that's been kind of watching the calendar and waiting for this date to come, it's probably Portland, just because of how they plan their offseason and how bizarre it looked for a time. And then you got to remember that this is, you know, an ownership group and a management group that knows what it's doing. So you would think, yeah, if there's a team that would maybe have something in the works, it's them, but you got to find a partner that's willing as well.
Yeah, no, I think the way that both the Magic and the Trailblazers compose their roster, like you said, during the offseason, we're hoping and assuming, at least maybe more
with
so
Portland,
for the Trailblazers.
Yeah, like I feel like Orlando just did it. And
well,
like,
we haven't afforded that same luxury to the Magic like
they
have the Trailblazers. I know you're right. They haven't earned it yet, but especially those two teams, those are the two teams that we're you're like, if they're going to make a trade before the trade deadline, it's possible for them to do it tomorrow. And since they've already had this grand scheme seemingly in place, why not just do it tomorrow? Let's go.
I mean, why though? Why do it tomorrow? It's not like there's a deadline where like you can only trade these guys
know,
on this day.
I know.
I mean,
but
the argument is like, yeah, you get more time with the guy that you're getting. You know, he's playing more games for your team, I guess.
Well, again, all the trades that will happen between now and the deadline are now eligible to happen tomorrow. So,
correct.
I mean, it seems like teams have this planned out somewhat, especially for guys on expiring contracts. You know, people always say, like, why are you going to trade for a guy on an expiring contract? It's most often, like you said, to just see how good of a fit he's going to be. So why would you not want three quarters of the season as opposed to just half a season?
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously a lot of reasons that guys like that are dealt. I think it really, really varies, you know, team by team. You know, a team like Cleveland is looking for an expiring deal for a one-year run. They're not looking to see how PJ Tucker is going to fit and like, oh, maybe we'll bring him back. It's like, if he's going to help us this season, that's what we're going for. But, you know, again, like a team like Orlando might see that differently, a team that's not competing this year. But let's get to what we really want to talk about on the podcast. we're going to do some redraft stuff. Always fun to kind of look back on NBA drafts, and James and I will do a ton more draft coverage on the podcast tomorrow. But we're going to kind of redraft the 2016 draft or the 2015 draft, or do them separately. And then it was your idea to just kind of combine them, because they're both like pretty weak as of right now. There's a top heavy, I guess maybe is the right word. So we're just going to pretend hypothetically that all the prospects from the last two drafts were in one class. And basically we're going to give our lottery or our top 15 or so prospects and explain why. So I'll let you go first.
Yeah, well, I started to do this year's draft class, and it was super boring. We did this last year, and it was a lot more interesting because you had
You need a little Porzingis more time, Russell, too.
But I don't know. I'm not nearly as inspired as I was redrafting last year's class. So I think it's fun to see how the classes stack up against each other. And if we do this in 365 days with this year's draft class, it would be very, very interesting. Because as James has told me and informed me, because he's more of a prospect guy, so are you. You know, like somebody like Jaylen Brown, James Anderson thinks that he would go 14th in this coming draft. So obviously,
James and I talked about that this morning, and in retrospect, it's kind of easy to say that, because Brown, he hasn't been bad, but, he just hasn't lit the world on fire. And, there's so many prospects right now in college basketball that are kind of doing that. And it's hard to say, how would he have been judged, if he's going up against these guys. But there's no doubt that the 2017 draft is stocked. And, there's an argument that, Brandon Ingram was the, lock number two prospect, or, some people thought number one prospect. I mean, he's doesn't go number one. He's not in consideration for the number one pick in 2017. And, it wouldn't be shocking if he went as low as four or five, which is kind of crazy because he's a great prospect. And guys, someone like a Chris Dunn, all of a sudden, James and I had the conversation of if you're Minnesota and you don't turn this thing around, and granted they got a win in Chicago the other night, but they were down 26-6 at one point in that game. They have issues still, very clearly. If you're Minnesota and you wind up with the fourth or fifth pick and you have a chance at Lonzo Ball or De'Aaron Fox, Dennis Smith, those guys are all arguably better prospects than Chris Dunn. And Dunn's a nice prospect, but he was a good prospect in was a pretty weak draft. You almost have to consider moving on from some of these guys who you might have taken in the last couple of years. Denver might be in the same situation with Moutier. There's four point guards in this draft that you would probably take for sure right now over Emmanuel Moutier. So again, James and I will cover that more on the pod tomorrow. I know you're not much of a present NBA draft guy, but let's talk about our redraft. So yeah, we agree.
Yeah, I love doing redrafts, but I just let you guys inform me of this coming year. You guys Fair. Do all the grunt work, and I just believe whatever you tell me. I think we can just skip and or not skip, but just give our first three picks because we're on par here. Karl Anthony Towns first, Porzingis second, Ben Simmons third. I don't think Kat Porzingis is really that earth shattering, right? Yeah. For me, in terms of the rookie and sophomore class, those are your top two guys in that order. The Ben Simmons things for me, coming in at third in relation to guys like Turner, Russell, Booker, Murray, Brandon Ingram, those guys, is kind of interesting, obviously, because he's never played an NBA game yet. But the fact that he's not a great shooter, he's probably even willing to admit that. Some comps have gone as far as, imagine Giannis running point, and that's similar to what Ben Simmons could do. But then again, you could also just judge him as basically just a taller Rajon Rondo. I mean, there's lots of different ways you can take it. And the thing here is that it's all up in the air. We don't know where it's going to be, but for whatever reason, you and I both feel comfortable listing him as number three on this list.
Yeah, and the other thing with the Sixers team is Simmons can play four positions probably if he can, if he can shoot it. Obviously, if he can learn to shoot it, I should say, you like him a little bit more at the two and the three off the ball. But the Sixers are in line to get two more lottery picks in this draft. One of which is probably going to be really high. The other of which is going to be the Kings pick if that. The Lakers pick, the Lakers stay out of the top three, which is looking like they will right now, and they hold the right to swap with the Kings. So in the event that the Sixers go on a run and the Kings tank, the Kings can't get the number one pick under any circumstances, but Philly, if the Kings are higher, could get that. So you have this core already around Simmons, and it's going to get even better, and it's going to be interesting to see who they add around him, and that might kind of help determine, where he fits long-term. But I still think even with Embiid, this is going to be Simmons' team. The way that the NBA works, the guy who handles the ball the most and who can create the most, that's most often whose team it is. Embiid in, you know, 10 years ago would have been a force. And I mean, he actually is a force now, but in terms of ball dominance, like I just don't know what we're going to see from him as far as, you know, how many possessions are they going to dump it down and let him work. He's not quite, you know, he has the size, I guess, of a Giannis, but he's not nearly that creative with the ball. He's not really a ball handler. Like, his ball handling is good for a 7-2 guy who's played 20 games, but like in the grand scheme of things, he can't really create. So I think this is going to be Ben Simmons' team, and I'm working on something right now for the site where Ben Simmons is right now my number two to win Rookie of the Year. He has yet to step foot on an NBA court. But I think, like, first of all, I don't think he's out of it to win Rookie of the Year, because how many games is Embiid going to play when it's all said and done? Like 60, 65?
Well, here's the thing about him is that he's perfectly spacing it out where he's the front runner for this competition and nobody's knocking him for only playing, you know, 50% of the games because he's spacing it out.
Embiid? Right.
Right. And so, like, when it comes down at the end of the season, I don't think anybody's actually going to knock him for not playing, but people will knock Ben Simmons even if he comes out and play and just balls out. People are going to say, not fair, didn't play the whole season.
Yeah, well, I think so. But I also think that the rest of the class has been so bad that if Ben Simmons comes back, let me see, like, how many games would he play? If he's back late January, we'll say, we'll give him even a little more. Like, say he comes back on, like, January 24th or something like that and plays almost every game the rest of the way. I mean, that still puts him at like 40, 45 games, which is, you know, not a ton by any means. But like 40 games, 45 games of him averaging something like 14, 8, and like 6. And I'm not saying that's what he's going to do, but he has the capability to do that. Like, that's how good this guy is. It wouldn't be a surprise if he put up those numbers. Like 45 games of that, would you take that over Embiid, 60 games of, you know, minutes restrictions, yes, up and down, crazy usage?
I'm taking Embiid. And it should be made clear, that's because fair. It should be made clear that Embiid's not eligible for this list we're creating because he was drafted 2 years ago. Even though he is a rookie, this is who was taken in the last 2 years draft class. Okay. But to be fair, I think we have so much exposure to Embiid where the numbers are going to come out. And even if Ben Simmons does just ball out, here's the thing though, Nick. I think that Simmons is going to be doing like in every other thing when he comes back. He's not going to be playing full minutes right off the bat. So
I still think he could finish second, though. Like,
yeah,
I mean,
sure.
Like Jamal Murray is like, I guess, quote unquote, solidly in second place right now. And is he's shooting like 40% or less, I think, from the field. Like,
just under.
It's a weak class right now. But, you know, too early to judge. We'll find out, I guess, in a couple of years what some of these guys are. But I had the same top three. I do think Porzingis has closed the gap quite a bit on Towns. I think, you know, the defensive metrics favor Porzingis this year. He seems like he's been more efficient, at least. He's been more consistent than he was last season. The numbers are pretty comparable for both. Porzingis, to me, though, still doesn't rebound at the rate you would think for a guy his size. And I don't really know what the reason is for that, to be honest. I mean,
he plays like, you know, beyond the arc
on and offense.
Guarding guys that play beyond the arc too. I mean, Robin Lopez is the guy guarding, Lopez. Wow, he's moved on.
That's what I'm saying. Like, who is, like, he just doesn't quite rebound at the same rate. Like, I don't know. Like Russell Westbrook rebounds 11 times a game and like he's on the perimeter. I don't know. I just think Porzingis could become a better rebounder but he still nonetheless has closed the gap on Towns. Part of that is Towns just not making the crazy leaps and bounds that we probably unrealistically expected. But those are our top three. You have Miles Turner at four. I went Devin Booker there. I have Turner at five. Not really hard to argue either way, I don't think. I mean, you could easily talk me into Turner at four.
I'm afraid to put Booker any higher than six right now. So I have Turner, Russell, Booker. If we just want to go in threes, you have Booker, Turner, Russell. So we have the same three guys, right?
Yep.
Booker's defense scares me a little bit. I don't think he's ever going to be like a Klay Thompson type defender. And here's the thing. His shooting from beyond the arc really hasn't been that great this year, and it wasn't necessarily that great last year either when he kind of has the full keys to the Phoenix Suns car. Considering that's what we knew he was going to do well or should be doing well is an issue. The fact that he's averaging as many points as he is right now is actually pretty great, like way ahead of standards considering that he's still like a young 20-year-old. So Turner just seems like a little bit better on defense. Obviously, they play completely different positions to the point where I say, you know what, he may never be a liability on defense at any point in his career once he finally gets going.
Turner?
Turner.
Yeah, I mean, he's been great on D.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, no doubt about that.
Yeah, the Pacers haven't been good. But and so, like, with Booker, it's like, yeah, he can light it up, but he's not shooting that great from beyond the arc, and I don't – he might actually be a liability on defense throughout a good portion of his career. So that's, for me, that's where I'm going to go. Russell is – it's just so hard last year because I just want to throw it out the window with the way Byron Scott treated him and Julius Randle. And so I still think all that glimmer and all that allure is still there. So I got him at five, but – I'm a little hesitant on Booker than I was at this time, you know, six months ago.
Right. At the raw numbers look better than the efficiency numbers do with Booker, that's for sure. Yeah, I mean, I can't really argue with those. 7, 8, 9. I went Ingram, Jamal Murray, and Jahlil Okafor. You went Murray, Ingram, and Justice Winslow.
Yes, Jamal Murray. So this is basically is the second best player out of the most recent draft class, is what we're saying. And for me, he came in at 7. For you, he came in at 8. That really is, you know, that says a lot about this year's draft class, honestly.
And I like Jamal Murray. It's just there's a ceiling there, I guess, with him that I get. There's something that like wouldn't surprise me that if we fast forwarded 3 years, like he was just really good, like really, really good. Because there were some games at Kentucky last year that you would watch and think like, this guy is insane. Like he just has that, like he has like the mindset and like the takeover gene, if there is such a thing. But I don't know that he has like the body or the athleticism to like really, really reach his peak. So we'll see. I think he's going to be really good. I just think the long-term potential of a guy like Booker, or Russell, to me kind of puts them ahead, but I really wouldn't be surprised if we did this in a year, Jamal Murray was a couple spots higher.
So here's the thing for me on Murray. He had a 4-game stretch this year where he faced the Thunder, the Jazz twice, and the Bulls, all four like pretty solid defensive teams, right? At the end of November, he was averaging 28.5 minutes. He put up 21 points, almost 5 rebounds, almost two assists, half a steal, 0.8 blocks, while shooting 50%, also over 3.3 three-pointers made during that stretch. For me, you know, if he's going to see almost 29 minutes per game, that kind of is what we can project for him next year. Once things thin out, or like our own RotoWire's own Andre Snelling says, when the Nuggets concentrate on who they have. And that to me is maybe even more enticing than what Booker is putting up now and seeing those exact minutes. So a lot to like from Murray. Ingram hasn't had one of those stretches yet, and I'm still a little bit concerned. Still super thin, hasn't been able to get to the rim as much as you would have liked, especially in comparison to some other rookies like Giannis is one that people throw out there quite a bit.
People were a little high on Ingram, and I cautioned James over the summer so many times on this. It was like, Ingram, I think he's going to be fine going forward, but like he's not NBA ready. He's rotation ready. He's, you know, ready to play for this Lakers team that's not in contention right now. But at the same time, you know, he's shooting 35% from the field over his last 7 games. He's very, very up and down in terms of night-to-night consistency. But at the same time, like you look and say, okay, you know, on my list, I have Ingram at 7, Murray at 8. Like right now, Murray might be the better, more productive player. But if you're the Lakers, would you trade Ingram straight up for Murray? No.
Well, that's only because you have Clarkson and Russell. If things were
I don't think they would do it either way. No way.
All right. It is a bit early, but in another half of season, when things thin out in Denver, it might be more clear that, hey, Murray might be a better option than Ingram.
I don't think the Lakers would make that decision for like another year. I don't care who else is on the roster. If you're just in a vacuum, we're like, we'll give you this guy for this guy. I don't think they're bailing on Ingram right now. Yeah.
This is a doomed argument because there just isn't enough time. I don't think many guys are going to bail on players they just picked up not that long ago. But I have Winslow at 9, and I kind of sheepishly put him in there just because I think he can be a staple and a starting five for the next 10 years of his career. By no means do I think that, you know, he's going to revolutionize any starting lineup, but I do think that having a long NBA career is worth quite a bit when we're analyzing such young guys. You have Okafor at 9.
I do.
And I have him at 11, and I just think that his defense and where the NBA is heading is just a major knock on him. I think that he can terrorize second-team defenses moving forward in his NBA career, but I just think there's a lot of interesting players that could be staples in starting fives, where I think Okafor is more of a second-team, like Al Jefferson type right now.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. The ceiling with him, I guess, is kind of limited, but like to me, he's so much better offensively than anyone else that's left on my list.
So here's the thing, though. I think that Okafor is as good offensively right now as he'll ever be in the NBA.
I don't think so. I mean, I think he was hurt for half of his rookie year. He's been hurt for part of this year. Hasn't really had all that time to work on it. But I mean, even if he doesn't get any better, like he's averaging like 18 and 8 per 36. Like, I mean, for being the, you know, 9th, 10th, 11th guy on our list, like I think that's fine. To me, like I have Winslow at 10, so I don't disagree all that much. The thing with Winslow is like a lot of people are kind of in denial, myself included, with the numbers, where it's like he looks good when he's on the court. He does a lot of good things when you watch. He does things that you can't quantify all that well, or things that are, you know, being quantified, I guess, more now than they were a few years ago. But he's third last in the NBA, you know, among qualified players in true shooting. Like he's a really, 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 like he's way worse offensively than people thought he was. And people didn't think he was that good. He's only played 9 games this year. So take from that what you will. And he's had a hurt wrist for who knows how many of those games, but 34% shooting. I mean, he shot 27% from 3 last year. You know, I think, like I said, he's going to be a really good defender. And I really do think he'll be fine long-term. But right now, there's not a lot of quantifiable data that says he's been very good, and he's been, you know, objectively really bad on the offensive end.
I completely agree with you. Like I said, I think more like somebody who's going to eat up 32 minutes a game for the next 2 seasons does have value, even though he is very, very much so struggling with his shot.
The fact that he's averaging 4 assists, though, for a non-prime, I mean, they have Goran Dragic on that team. It's not like they're asking him to handle the ball a ton. Like I think he has really good vision. He'll even if he does figure out his shot, like he would never be a shooting guard who just averages like 2 assists or 1 assist a game. Like he gets it, I think, as a passer, and I think that'll really, you can't teach something like that. And I think he'll be all right long term.
Yeah, I agree with you. So
okay,
moving forward, next 3, I have Marquese Chris, which I feel bad about. Okafor, and then Moutier. You have Winslow, Lyles, and Sabonis. Chris is somebody that's not even on your board, and I'm willing to admit perhaps I have him too high. I think where the NBA is headed, the fact that he does attempt and make some 3-pointers, that he could get it. Now, a lot of the early indication out of Phoenix is that, you know, he's just not going to understand basketball schemes.
He tried to beat up Kristaps last night. Like that was,
and he didn't even fight back.
That was kind of sweet, though.
He started it and then
he stood right over him. I thought he did. He threw him down and then kind of like stood over him before Brandon Jennings and Chandler and whoever else got in there. Like, I'm not going to say I like someone throwing someone to the ground, but I mean, he's not. I like that for a really young rookie who hasn't been playing basketball all that long, and probably no one on the Knicks even knew who he was. Like I like that fire, and you know, maybe you don't express it that way, but I was fine with it.
Yeah, I'm okay with it, but I mean, I guess this for me is the riskiest guy to have on the list. And yes, I have him at 10, but you know, his athleticism at 6'10", where the NBA is headed, again, the fact that he shoots threes, there's a lot of, you know, the ceiling is really high with him. The problem that, again, the floor is very, very low, maybe the lowest out of anybody that we're going to talk about today.
I think the fact that he's playing over Dragan Bender says a lot. Not that Phoenix has been good or that Chris has even been good. I mean, he hasn't really been. He's shooting 43%, but like for a guy who's, you know, half of his field goal attempts basically have come from 3, like that's not horrible. And like we thought, you know, Bender's raw, and jury's totally still out on him. Like this is not an indictment on Bender, but I thought Chris was like even more raw. And the fact that he's been able to at least get into the rotation, I think says something about him.
I think this is an indictment on Bender. We don't have him on our list, and somebody who was definitely a project is starting over him, playing more minutes than him. It is an indictment on Bender. That's exactly what it is.
There is a little bit of like a Hezonja feel with him,
boy.
But we'll see. I mean, I think we really have no idea with him, but so yeah, I had Lyles at 11. Don't really have a lot to say. He's just really solid. You know, probably not going to move higher or lower from that spot in a few years. Sabonis at 12. You know, rotational guy, starter for a pretty good team in the West. The fact that they're comfortable playing him says a lot, I think. 13 through 15. Let's finish these up quickly. Well, I guess you have Moutier at 12. Let's talk about that. I did not include him on my list because he is a bad basketball player.
Okay, that's fair. I understand that argument. You know, I'm at the point in the list where I'm willing to concede to any like general logic. The thing for me that made me put him on the list is that point guards take longer to catch on in the league, and maybe at some point he'll get it at some point in the next couple of years. So for that reason, the fact that he is pretty athletic, he is a big point guard, I'll toss him on this top 15 list for now.
I do wonder with Moutier, like, if you put like Sean Kilpatrick on this team and played him as much as they play him and have the ball in his hands as much, like, does he put up the same numbers?
I mean, if he moves it down to a shooting guard spot, would we be saying this? I mean, I don't think we would.
He can't shoot.
Well, yeah, that's
obviously. That's a problem. He can't play shooting guard because he can't shoot the ball.
Yeah, I guess if he just wasn't entrusted with so much responsibility, maybe the light wouldn't shine so bright on him.
He's just gotten worse. Like he had so many bright spots last year that every time you'd get down on him, he would have a week where he'd play really well. And it's like everything's down. Assists are down. Scoring is, I guess, up by 0.3. The rebounding is, you know, minimal improvement there, and that's kind of fluky for a point guard. Field goal percentage is down. Three-point shooting is down on more attempts. Like, I mean, this is kind of the disaster scenario for Denver. The nice thing is you have Jamal Murray playing really well, and, you know, you're getting another draft pick, and you have a lot of assets. But I do wonder on Mudiay, like, do they sell high on him at some point or sell low, I guess, on him, you know, kind of a Carter Williams situation? And I mean, MCW wasn't all that good, but Moutier has been markedly worse.
Yeah, Jamal Murray. We've talked about with Harrison Wynn. Jamal Murray can play point guard, and that's somebody that we like a lot. Mm-hmm. I have him at number 7. You have him at number 8. Finishing out the 15, I have Sabonis at 13 for the reasons you said. Lyles, I'm not crazy about him. I asked James for his list, unofficial list, and he had Lyles at like 8 or something like that. He's still pretty high on him. I finish out with Brown. You have Brown, Dunn, Decker. That 15 spot was up in the air for me. I don't feel good about Brown, but why did you include Decker over basically the rest of the field?
Decker's been good. And that's why. I mean, he's kind of with the rest of these guys, you know, someone like Brown and even Dunn and Sabonis to some degree, you're projecting out a lot. And like Decker didn't play almost at all in his rookie season. He played like 6 total minutes or something like that. And he's been like a really, really nice bench spot or bench piece for this Houston team. Like the numbers aren't great, 7-4, you know, with an assist, but he's shooting 38% from three. He's shooting 51% from the floor. Like he just looks like he's going to be a really good seventh man, you know, in the future for the next 10 years.
Dunn? I mean, I haven't seen anything from him. Dunn's been bad,
yeah. But he's still Chris Dunn. And like, I don't know. I think I just like him too much as a prospect and as a college player to give up on him. Like he's shooting like 40% from the field, which is not good, but there's been rookie point guards that have shot a lot worse than that. So I'm not ready to give up on him. And like, I think he's the one guy that in a year or two, if I look back and I'm just like, wow, I thought this was the 14th best guy out of these two drafts. Like he could shoot up a lot more to me than Brown or than certainly Decker, Lyle, Sabonis. Brown to me too, though. I mean, he really hasn't played that bad. The numbers don't look good, but he's
not sexy.
He's shooting like 46% from the field, which for a rookie that, you know, takes a lot of tough shots as he does, I don't think is horrible. 38% from three and low volume of attempts.
That was a tiebreaker for me, is that he's shooting so well now.
I might put him higher. Both of those guys, I think, I would probably put ahead of Lyles and Sabonis if I did this again.
So here's one notable omission, and then I'm going to go over all of them. But the reason why we put Sabonis, like playing solid minutes on a good team, why aren't we saying that with Pascal, Siakam? That's the first time I've ever said his name, by the way. So no wonder.
Yeah, butchered that's
it.
Fair. That's
but I mean,
fair.
He's doing the exact same thing, putting up solid numbers. That's somebody who's not getting a lot of respect in terms of rookie and sophomore guys in the NBA.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, I think that's fair for sure. You know, you could kind of swap him out with any of those 13 through 15 guys. Malcolm Brogdon, even, you know, he's been pretty good for the Bucks.
The way that I looked at this is if, like, all the rookies and sophomores that were taken in the last 2 years, obviously, not including Embiid, were thrown back into a draft, how would it go down?
Yeah.
And, you know, you kind of do revert back to those Duns and those Jaylen Browns that were not, you know, it wasn't that long.
We're not ranking, like, how good they've been so far. It's if you were redoing these drafts and these players were being selected right now,
today,
you know, it's like, like if you want to go with like production, like, yeah, maybe Josh Richardson's included or like,
I thought
Norman
about
Powell,
him.
Like Norman Powell. I don't know.
Notable admissions from 2015 NBA draft. Obviously, Hezonja is perhaps one of the biggest ones. Cauley Stein, Stanley Johnson, Frank Kaminsky, Cameron Payne, Kelly Oubre Jr., Terry Rozier, Rashad Vaughn. 2016 draft, notable admissions, a whole lot, obviously. Bender, Heald, Jakob Poeltl, Thon Maker, Torian Prince. But as we look at it now, and even if we look at it down the road, I think the 2015 NBA draft class is markedly better than the 2016, and this exercise has somewhat proven that.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's for sure the case, and, you know, if you want to go by like rookie classes, adding Embiid, I think, you know, brings even more firepower, of course, to you know, this 2016 class. But yeah, just going purely off draft classes, I mean, it's looking like you know, we just one of some of these, someone in the lottery, it's not like it's going to be Ben Simmons and everyone else just sucks in 5 years, but like one or two of those guys are going to emerge. But it's looking right now like the best player, you know, that like no one, Ben Simmons hasn't even played a game, hasn't even been close to playing a game. And we're very confident that he's the best player in this class. Like that says, that to me says a lot.
Yeah, no, I think you're totally right.
Okay. I got to talk about Blitz Pick.
You got to talk about it?
Unless you want to.
I'll talk
you
about it.
You do it. Yes,
I'll talk
you
about
do it,
it.
Please.
Good friends at Blitz Pick, do you enjoy playing daily fantasy sports but struggle to find the time to research players and track news, especially on mobile devices? Well, download Blitz Pick, your DFS command center. Blitz Pick is a state-of-the-art mobile companion for FanDuel and DraftKings users, featuring a lineup optimizer, player news, injury alerts, historical stats, and much more. Their proven lineup optimizer incorporates advanced analytics and game theory to keep you a step ahead of the competition. Blitz Pick's news comes directly from us here at RotoWire, ensuring you never miss a story. Get injury alerts pushed directly to your phone as soon as the news breaks. Blitz Pick even recommends the best replacements. Check out their value play section for the right players to build your lineups around. You can also pick a few and then let Blitz Pick Optimizer do the rest, or fill in your lineup manually, relying on their accurate projections. Blitz Pick is available on the iPhone and Google Play stores.
All of that is correct.
It's all very, very true. What are you looking forward to the rest of the week in the NBA? For me, it's the trades. Like, I hope trades happen tomorrow. I hope they just break.
Is there a precedent for that? I don't know.
No,
I don't remember that being the case.
Let a guy dream.
I guess. Yeah, I'm not getting my hopes up. Yeah, I'll have to look at the schedule. I've just been laser focused on UWGB versus Wisconsin.
Oh my gosh.
Tonight.
Here's what I want to ask you, because it's taking some heat around the league. The back-to-back Memphis versus Cavs game, Cavs electing to rest, you know, the majority of their top players. Kyrie yesterday and now the big three today. J.R. Smith is going to be the best player on the court for the Cavaliers tonight
sure
in Memphis.
Is.
What do you think about that?
What do I think about JR being the best player for the Cavs? I mean,
what do you think about the fans in Memphis Cavalier fans in Memphis?
It's not the Cavaliers' responsibility to
take an NBA commissioner stance on this.
They don't owe the Grizzlies anything. It's the Grizzlies' fault if they don't have players who can draw attendance. To me, and I get that that's kind of a cynical way to look at it, but like you can't. Where do you draw the line where you say like, okay, you can rest. Like if the Cavs were resting J.R. Smith because he had sore legs, like that's why Kyrie's resting. He has sore legs. He said he just couldn't push off, so he's resting. Like no one would care if they were resting J.R. or they were resting Shumpert, but since it's Kyrie and since it's LeBron, like at what point do you say like, okay, this guy's too good. He compensates for this much in ticket sales. You can't rest him, but you can rest this guy because no one's actually here to see him. If you want to go see the Cavaliers, go to Cleveland and watch the Cavaliers. I totally get it. And like, if I was a kid, especially, you know, who had been wanting to see LeBron and whose parents paid all this money to go see him, like, of course I'd be disappointed. And that's totally rational. But like, you can't, LeBron doesn't owe anything to the city of Memphis. Like he shouldn't be made out as to feel bad that he's resting, you know, or I don't know, when is he supposed to build in this rest? Like at home when he's not disappointing, you know, other fans in Cleveland can see him other nights. Like, I don't get it.
Do you think it's about to become an epidemic? We have Aldridge sitting out tonight against the Celtics. We have Cousins sitting out. I mean, the Kings are still like somewhat reasonably in the playoff picture. I know that sounds crazy to say, but let's be honest here. No team gives up this early in the competition, at least not for rest purposes.
I think the Kings saw this as like, all right, McLemore and Gay are already out. We probably weren't going to win this game anyway. Why waste Cousins and play him 40 minutes? Like, let's just take the loss that we were going to get anyway and get Cousins some rest. That's how I see that.
Okay. I think it becomes a broader issue when you have bad and poor teams doing it
yes.
as well.
Well, yeah, that's another thing too, is like when the Spurs did it, you know, and they were penalized by the league for doing it because it was a national TV game. Mm-hmm. That was something where people I felt like took the Spurs side there, right? For the most part, especially like the basketball writing, Twitter, whatever community took the Spurs side. And it was, you know, they're being smart about it. Why would they throw their guys out 82 games a year? But yeah, it's different. Like the way it's viewed if you're a bad team is like, well, why do you care? Like your player should be out there. You're bad. You need to win. Like, yeah, there seems to be like this, you have to be X good of a team to earn the right to rest your players, which I don't know if I agree with.
Yeah, I don't know. It's becoming an issue. I'm seeing a lot of more, the season should be shortened, which I don't necessarily agree with.
That's what this all comes back to, I think, is like, all right, if you're not going to shorten the season, then we're going to shorten it ourselves by not playing as many games.
If you're going to shorten it, I think some people have come out and said like 30 games, 35 games. I think that's ridiculous. I think the lowest it should ever be is 60.
That's even a lot.
Well, not even 60, but like 58 or something like that. You need to play everybody at least twice home and home, and that should be the minimum. So what is that like?
No, I mean, I think 60 is like – that's cutting off 22 games. Like to me, that's a lot. I think
– I agree.
I think just going down to like 72 even would be would be huge as far as the number of back-to-backs and like removing 10 games off the schedule. I mean, what you could do with that schedule-wise – I think would be a lot. Even like even removing five games in the grand scheme of things would be a lot, because like how many times are you really resting LeBron a year? Like five, right? You know, if you can just take those games out, all of a sudden you don't need to rest him.
Yeah, it's the back to backs and it's like the four games in 5 days that people get all up in arms about, and rightly so. The reason why it's 82 right now, or the reason that makes sense to me, is because you play your opposing conference twice, and then you play your in conference, you know, Western, Eastern, four times.
Yeah,
and so if I mean, keep it even, if anything, do a 2 and 3 or something like that, because you have to have a chance for the, you know, the NBA is just set up. It's not quite like the NFL. Everybody should be traveling to each city, so any number below 60 to me is just stupid and arbitrary.
Yeah, I mean, and it's tough too, because like if you are a Midwestern team, you're inherently traveling fewer miles because you don't have to go coast to coast ever. You know, like the farthest you're ever going is one coast back to the Midwest or other coast back to the Midwest. Like that's proven. Like the West Coast and the East Coast teams travel more.
Well, I don't know about the East Coast, because like DC and the New Yorks and Bostons are so close together that it's a lot different between Salt Lake going to Minnesota or the Thunder going to Salt Lake, because like the teams within your own division are actually like 500 mile jaunts compared to the East. So I don't know. It's always different for every team, but you're right.
I don't know even
like,
that.
A team like Portland travels a ton.
Yeah. I don't know that like it comes down to mileage. Like, I mean, I don't know. I'm full disclosure. I'm not an NBA player. Never have been. I don't know why it's taken me so long to reveal that. But I would think that like traveling is traveling at some point. You know, obviously a cross country flight is different than, you know, flying from DC to Orlando or something like that. But at the same time, I think it's just like the process of traveling and having to spend an hour checking into your hotel, hour getting back on the plane, and then the bus. Like, just all that, I think, together. Like, I don't know that mileage or distance traveled is the bigger thing as far as like just number of sheer trips that you're on.
Yeah, no, that's completely fair. Anyways, lots of good stuff to look forward to. Lots of good stuff we talked about now. Love talking about redrafting. That's one of my favorite topics that we do.
It is.